Hey, everybody. Scene Stealers Podcast. We're back after a week off. It's Trevin McGee, if you didn't know. For some reason, it's the first one you've listened to. And I'm here, as always, with Trey Hawk and Eric Moline. We didn't do one last week because, we had a lot of stuff to do. We had a lot of stuff to do, and none of it involved seeing the internship.
Yeah.
So we skipped it.
Trevin and I just had to, we bottomed out.
I really bottomed out, too. I didn't go see it either.
Yeah.
I decided to write an article about product placement instead.
Nice.
Yeah. He would rather do his job than go see the internship. What's that tell you?
Yeah.
But apparently we made the right decision because no one else saw it this weekend either. It opened at number 5 behind The Purge and then everything else that had already been out. So.
Now, we do have a review of The Purge on our site from Brian Reeves, who is kind of turning into our resident horror guy.
Yeah. Which we
needed
cause,
one.
Yeah, because Trey and I are both scaredy cats. And
yeah, I mean, horror scares us.
Or it's just bad. That might be part of it, too.
Or it scares us and is bad, which is the worst. Like, that's the worst when you're sitting there and you're watching a movie that you're like, this is garbage, and still it's making you tense and anxious, because then you're anxious and tense and scared and angry.
Yeah.
It must be doing something right, then, if you're anxious.
Pop-up scares, you know, pop-up scares are just a weakness of mine. They're not clever and they're not well done.
Yeah.
It's just they make me anxious. And so I can recognize that it's like, oh my God, that scared me and that was so cheap. So
you're scared and angry. That's
scared
just
and
the
angry.
Worst place to be.
Yeah, that's so usually what I'm
What are we talking about today?
We've got three movies.
We've
today.
Got The Man of Steel.
We've got Man of Steel. Yeah. We've got This is the End and the new Britt Marling,
The East.
The East.
Yep.
And we got to do our one things, and I'll start with that. This is like a super nerdy week. It's like yesterday was like the perfect storm of all these nerdy interests, but I'll just stick with the film stuff. I watched Behind the Candelabra over the weekend, the new Steven Soderbergh movie. I think
there's a free HBO preview this weekend, so I'm going to try to catch it.
He distributed it directly to HBO, and it's awesome. The entire movie looks like it was lit by candlelight or through one of those Swarovski crystals. It's incredible. I think Matt Damon plays.
Do they have a cross filter? Does every light like?
Yeah, every light diffuses, and oh my God, it's incredible. And I think that Damon is too old for his character. Because his character, Scott, it's a very simple story. Like, this guy ends up meeting Liberace and becomes his driver and partner and lover and all this kind of stuff. And it's really just a relationship movie about, like, somebody with a huge ego and what happens when they come together. And then situations just kind of pull them apart. But it was really well done. I really hope Michael Douglas wins a bunch of things for his portrayal of Liberace. He's incredible, and he looks the part, and it's a great little movie. I mean, it's Soderbergh, so of course it is, but if this is the beginning of his, like, era of television, I am really excited, because it's a great opening shot from him, so I recommend seeing that.
Awesome.
Eric?
Look forward to it. I pass.
You pass?
I have
you don't
nothing.
Want to talk about how great Air Guitar went
Air
last
Guitar
Friday?
Air Guitar was awesome. It was amazing. Thank you for being air traffic control.
Well, you're welcome. Wasn't fishing for a compliment, but I'll take it. Trey, what about you?
I can go along with this sort of nerd week because my one thing is, again, film school. But
oh, God, I know which one this is. I have a story about this movie.
I'm so excited about this week because this week is as, like, cult film as they come.
Mm-hmm.
This week, this Saturday, 2 p.m., we're showing Heavy Metal.
It's our one-way ticket to midnight.
It really is. And I, you know, I remember seeing this film as a midnight screening mm-hmm. in high school, and just basically everybody hooting and hollering, and like underage kids sneaking in, like, you know, coke laden with whatever alcohol that they could fit into a large Quick Trip cup. This is just, you know, this is just one of those kind of crazy films that got made for no good reason in the 80s. That, like, you were just kind of like, how did this get greenlit? And in some ways it's because it was a Canadian production. Like, I mean, same way with Meatballs, which we showed a couple of weeks ago, which was awesome to see on the big screen. you know, we just showed Cherry 2000, which the turnout was a little bit down, which is kind of what I would expect for Cherry 2000. But I always forget how great the satire in Cherry 2000 is. If you haven't seen it for a while and you don't remember it fondly, go back and watch Cherry 2000. It is hilarious. It is biting. It is really significantly better. I guarantee you it is significantly better than you remember it. But this week it's kind of one of those undeniable forces that it's just like, hey, go back to the glory days of high school when you were watching movies late at night and just like hanging out with
this
friends. Movie's
or if you just really want to be, if you really just want to see huge cartoon boobs, you should go.
Yeah. This movie's synonymous with Night Flight. You guys remember that TV show Night Flight on TBS?
Yeah.
No.
It was like NBC had Friday Night Videos when MTV was popular.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the TV networks felt like they had to get something on. And then there was Night Flight.
Did they cut the movie into little music videos?
No. Night Flight was essentially the druggy, sexier, rock and roll, more dangerous version of MTV and Friday Night Videos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on TBS.
Okay.
And they would run
so far, so good.
All kinds of crazy heavy metal videos by bands you've never heard of, like Kix and Alcatraz. And then they'd have like Loudness, the Japanese heavy metal band, on. And then
That's
they'd have
awesome.
Like classic rock videos. And everybody would be, you know, they'd have little short films and things like that. They would actually put short films on the air.
Yeah.
But usually they had to do with rock and roll or drug content or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that they even showed a censored version of heavy metal on Night Flight.
Yeah.
You can now find
it
Night
was five
Flight
minutes long.
Online. There's some guy that's trying to, the guy who owns it is trying to like put it back up, all the content back up as a blog that people have already put out there.
Huh.
But heavy metal is like really ingrained in that party, rock and roll, drug subculture
mm-hmm.
from the late 70s and early 80s that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like an outgrowth of the people that you saw in Dazed and Confused. You know, and
like
also,
those people would become the
the ones that like kept getting high and went to art school made heavy metal.
And there's that
basically
weird crossover because of the magazine, because a heavy metal magazine, which cropped up because of the popularity of books like Lord of the Rings and people's need to see these visualized fantasy versions of this stuff.
And then Simon Beisley bought it and it turned into a tit mag.
Yeah, but I mean, it kind of was going there anyway.
Well, I mean, it was already pretty much there. But
so it's a weird, weird movie.
It's a
weird movie. It just doesn't, like, I don't like it necessarily. And I remember even as a kid, I thought, wow, this is really bad. Like, this movie is not good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something unique about it. It'd be interesting to see today.
And really, it's mainly for the event. Like, if you're going to go see this movie, go and see it with a crowd, because that's when it's a blast.
Yeah.
It's kind of like
watching
Rocky.
If you watch it
by
yourself, you're just watching, like, nude cartoons alone in your house.
It's kind of like watching Rocky Horror by yourself at home.
Right.
It's really bizarre. It's the interactivity, and it's this sort of cult following that grew up around it that makes it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I can't say any more than this, but there are going to be a number of surprises also.
Ooh.
That's all I've got.
You're going to have cocaine for everybody?
There's going to be
Ghost of John
of
Candy.
That's
the Ghost of John Candy is going to provide live commentary.
That's all I'm saying. All
right.
That's all I can say.
Well, let's move on from things we enjoy to things we didn't and talk about Man of Steel.
Are we going straight into Man of Steel, or are you going to do This as the End?
No, let's do Man of Steel.
Let's hit Man of Steel. That's the big giant one. So Man of Steel, Zack Snyder, co-produced by Christopher Nolan, of Superman reboot, and kind of bringing him into the modern age, new dark story. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes long, and I literally saw it last night.
It was
and
only
I'm,
2:15?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, it was 147 minutes, yeah. I'm trying really hard to... I saw it last night, and I'm trying really hard to remember anything of substance about it. Like a day later. Yeah, you can go ahead and start.
First, I'm going to start with my overall feeling about, like, when I walked out of the theater, how I felt about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did
about,
you feel, Eric?
Well, Every now and then, when you see a bad superhero movie,
uh-huh.
you feel like you should never have to see another one again.
Right.
And I felt that way after watching Green Lantern.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that even though the Marvel films, the films in the Marvel Universe since The Incredible Hulk are not perfect, that at least they are entertaining and diverting enough to keep me interested, right? They're not perfect. I think the Iron Man 3 was definitely better than Iron Man 2 and blah, 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 and certainly The Avengers, even I know Trey didn't like it or whatever, but those movies have a certain warmth and wit and fast-paced style
yeah.
that makes them very watchable. Watching the first 45 minutes of Man of Steel was one of the worst experiences I've had in the theater this year. And I think that it is because we've seen so many versions of Superman, and Superman is one of the original superheroes. So many of these origin stories are so similar to that, even if they don't have Russell Crowe flying around on a crazy alien dragon trying to save his world before it blows up. It's essentially the same thing. And so when presented with a ultra serious version of that, that has no sense of humor and no forward drive or real energy to it, it's just dead. It's just like, I can't take it anymore. And then
yeah.
and then I feel like Zack Snyder's response to the people that didn't like Superman Returns because they said there wasn't enough action in it was to make sure that as he's telling his story, there's an action scene every 10 or 15 minutes. And that the plot the plot is advanced yeah. through action in almost every scene in the entire movie.
Yeah.
And the cumulative effect of that, while I think that's an interesting strategy to keep people interested, the cumulative effect of that and Hans Zimmer's score was this bombastic
bludgeoning.
Bombardment. Just, bludgeoning, yeah. And yeah. it just got to the point where even as Lois Lane entered the picture and all of a sudden it became more interesting,
mm-hmm.
I was done. And yeah. and by the time the bombast continued, I was even more done. And yeah. and despite the fact that Michael Shannon is in the film, who's one of my favorite bad guys, and yeah. was so fun in Premium Rush, which is a trifle of a film compared to this, and so much more entertaining than this, I just couldn't take it anymore. There's something about this movie that just dragged me down.
You do get some good Shannon yell, though.
You get
and yeah, I always look for a good Shannon meltdown, and you get a nice like Michael Shannon
it's
meltdown.
Like in Premium Rush, he had some funny lines, not uh-huh. a lot, but he did so much with almost nothing in that film, and I feel like yeah. here he had to advance the plot so much that he wasn't able to make anything interesting out of it.
It's a situation, I think, because I feel like this film is a failure also. But it's one of those situations where he's trying to split the difference in a bad way. And what he's splitting the difference between is...
You're talking about Snyder?
Yes. It is doing almost like a superhero character drama, like Ang Lee did.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that's why Ang Lee's Hulk... like alienated a whole lot of people. Why I find it really fascinating, whether it's a success or a failure, that's an argument for another time, or for a time that's long past.
Yeah.
But he tried to split it between it being a character drama and being an action film.
And he did it with flashbacks, which actually I enjoyed.
I thought it was, yeah.
Why am I still hating this movie, like disliking this film, despite
Here's
the
why.
Flashbacks working?
Because the character drama doesn't have enough character
mm-hmm.
to make it work, because it's undermined by the action film.
And it's a template that we're so familiar with, we just bring all that into it and that's supposed to be enough.
Absolutely. And the action film is undermined by the dreadfully slow pacing at times of the developing character drama. So he basically splits the difference in the worst possible way. He doesn't commit to, you know, let's say this were a 95-minute film. He could commit to the first 45 minutes being nothing but character drama. like develop the character, really get in there, like really get these people.
Like the first Spider-Man movie or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. And then 45 minutes in, all hell breaks loose, right. And it's just game on. Yeah.
Instead, all hell breaks loose from the beginning with Russell Crowe flying around on some sort of lizard.
From heavy metal. I think there was a leftover creature design from heavy metal. Yeah.
Can I just say how much I disliked all of the alien the design?
And costume stuff. Costume design and character design. It all looks like some sort of bizarro H.R. Geiger, you know, sex toy nightmare.
Alien Prometheus kind of world, and it was like, I don't know why.
Do you want to tell them what you asked?
Oh,
me?
I said that everything from Krypton either looks like dildos or vaginas. Yeah. And when you go and see this film, because everybody will, you'll see exactly what I mean.
The little pods that they get confined into. Like when that happened, Trey leaned over and I was like, "You don't have to say that."
Yeah. Everything. Yeah. I mean, it all looks like that, and it's just I don't know who has told these character designers and these costume designers that, like, all black, you know, all black and armorish and that type of stuff, that's going to be the way to go. That's the way we're going. That's the only way we're going because we've seen it in Dark Knight, I mean, which kind of makes sense, but a little pop of color might help. We've seen it in a couple of the X-Men movies where it's just all muted
all
tones.
Black leather and
yeah,
nonsense.
I mean, we just kind of keep seeing this. Prometheus was a perfect example, you know, of this kind of like. But Prometheus makes sense because it's going along.
The art direction in Prometheus was the best thing about it.
Yeah, right, but it's going along. It's already a built-in quantity with the alien movie.
But somehow it was brighter and shinier and more sleek. And in this movie, he's using those. I don't know, the grainier tone and the darker.
I think it's just a mistake. Kind of
everything was supposed to have a utility to it, and I understood that, but it didn't necessarily mean that I appreciated it. I actually didn't mind the stuff on Krypton at all. It's a funny kind of.
It was a slog.
Well, it's the funny kind of dichotomy you guys set up because, like, this starts with action and just kind of continues, and then we get sort of the origin through flashbacks are sort of the decisions that bring him to where we see him at the beginning through flashbacks. And I think that I actually prefer that just because so many times in recent superhero movies, like the Marvel template is definitely a template. First movie is the origin.
Yeah.
First movie is like normal guy becomes super, deals with it, fights villain, learns lesson. And that template follows Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, like that, you know, and then obviously the Spider-Man movies, even though those aren't Marvel properties. But that's a pretty well-worn first superhero movie trope. I mean, even Batman Begins follows it. So I liked that they didn't do that this time, because I've seen it so many times.
I enjoyed the flashback.
And I think I definitely enjoyed it more than either of you, but I can't give it, like, a recommendation necessarily. I mean, it definitely, if you are going to see it, I don't think it's going to play well on a television set. Like, I think that it looks way better in a theater and should be, like, if you are going to see it, it's definitely one that you should see in theater, which everyone's going to see it. So.
But I have to add, the 3D was, there's nothing.
No, and the IMAX.
I appreciated that it wasn't gimmicky, but there's no reason to see it in 3D. Yeah. I mean, it goes along with my thing that I don't think that there are but two movies that you need to see in 3D ever.
Yeah, and they're both documentaries.
Both documentaries.
Yeah, and the other thing, the scope of IMAX and 3D don't really suit the way that he chooses to direct action scenes, especially towards the end when they're so fast and so much is going on. Mm-hmm. The things that really threw me more were on the technical side, like. I didn't mind any of the performances. The script needed a little bit of work and whatever. But on the technical side, like, why did he decide to go, like, handheld at the times he decided to go handheld? Hmm. Like, why the fuck did he choose the specific moments he chose to get all shaky cam and crazy? Like, after being so restrained and metered for so much of the movie, why is it that when all hell breaks loose, he just decides to go crazy? Like, is it supposed? I guess,
because
you know,
it ups
maybe
the anxiety.
Yeah, maybe to make it more frantic to match what's happening in the story.
But,
but it's
the
totally
action
confusing
scenes.
And disastrous. And the big, you know, like for a movie that's 90% action anyway, the big climactic action sequence, I had gotten up and gone to the bathroom and I didn't want to come back and climb across a bunch of people and sit back. So it wasn't a full screening, so I just sat down in like the fifth or sixth row. There was no one else in it, so I just sat dead center. And that combined with 3D, combined with IMAX, and then the way he chose to direct those scenes, it's like, I have no idea what the fuck is going on. Like, I just can't make heads or tails of... I felt like I was 80 years old, honestly. I just felt I was confused.
I was gonna compliment the action scenes, really? Actually. I was happy that that he didn't show his fetish for slow-mo at all.
Yeah.
It's definitely ultra-violence. Obviously, this is his first PG-13
I disagree. I think there's ridiculous violence in this. But it's bloodless,
exactly,
ugly.
That's the bloodless Michael Bay violence.
I think that makes it more despicable.
Well, what was despicable, or at least I still don't understand why he did it, was not just the fact that all the buildings in New York City / Metropolis are falling to the ground.
Yeah, and usually Metropolis is supposed to be Chicago, but for some reason they made it New York this time.
Yeah,
which is
but,
weird.
But not
anyway.
Just is that happening, but the iconography of having the ashes come down from the sky on people's faces and be covered in them and have to try to... I mean, apparently there's only three other people in New York that we care about. and we don't even know them, so we don't.
And they
care
all get together.
Them.
They were all luckily they all traveled in a pack.
Yeah,
you know,
but even at the end, when everything's okay, they're all insulting each other. It's like I don't really understand any of this or why I should care. But I don't know. I don't. It was heavy. It was more heavy-handed to me almost than the 9/11 stuff that J.J. Abrams tried to fit into the Star Trek movie.
Right.
Maybe just because of the iconography of the ashes and stuff,
yeah.
But. Yeah, so you can't have superheroes smashing up every building in New York and having people running for their lives knowing that there's untold amount of casualties.
Yeah.
And then simply just brush it aside.
Yeah, he has no emotional heaviness
at
to
least
it at the
in
end.
Iron Man 3, they address the fact that in the Avengers there was a fucking alien invasion and that changed the universe as they know it.
Right.
At least they did that. Let's give them credit for that, because this movie doesn't do that. The other thing I wanted to say about this film is that we've seen so much of Superman's origin story before that the flashback idea was great, but not all of the flashbacks are successful.
No.
There's a particular one where his father takes a stand on something and it ends up changing both of their lives. And that was almost laughable.
Yeah.
And so when I think because you mentioned that the script needed work, mm-hmm. I think the dialogue needed work more than anything else in this film. If you leave the script as is and you punch up the dialogue and give us characters in those brief moments, what Joss Whedon did so good in The Avengers, or I feel he did, was give us snippets of character with humor. So that even in this ensemble cast, we have people that we can kind of relate to or care about or get behind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And or at least we know that their one character trait is defining them. And in this film, it was so overly serious. And this is the problem that he had in 300 and Watchmen.
Yeah.
Is that you're just... It's just too much. You can't take it anymore because... And I don't know why Nolan, and you would disagree with me on this again, Trey, I don't know why Nolan is able to get away with it. Batman Begins is my least favorite of the three Batman movies, but I think as an origin story, it still works.
Yeah.
And there's something about Man of Steel that is so otherworldly, and they keep calling him an alien, which I think is appropriate. I like what they were trying to do there, but there's something so otherworldly and bigger about it that when the alien...
Zod,
but when the alien way of... When the superpowered aliens descend upon puny Earth,
mm-hmm.
We get the scale in one big awesome fight in the Midwest. In
Kansas. That was my favorite part of the whole movie. That was incredible.
And then from there, it's just more of the same, and it's downhill. And then you start to realize, well, if there's really nothing we can do about this, and there's only one guy who can challenge them, there's nowhere to go from here. Superman is a frustrating character.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it.
He's a tough character to do.
But I was just
only,
very unsatisfied when this was over and I can't quite put my finger on it.
I don't have the knowledge that Aaron and Alan have, when it comes to comic books, but I can only think of two writers that ever did him justice. Like Alan Moore wrote a one-off story about him called Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. and it just kind of told the last days of Superman and how he disappeared, and that's a great one-off story. And then Grant Morrison did a great two-part, two-volume thing called All-Star Superman. And there's actually a great Pa Kent story in that that I was kind of hoping they'd steal from, because it explains how he died, and he died because Clark was being irresponsible with his powers and was, like, gone, and so he missed it. His dad had a heart attack while he was away doing, like, showboating and testing his powers and everything, so he learns a lesson from that. You know, he learned, like, I was hoping they were going to do something more like that, not what we got in the movie, which was really, it was pretty silly, the way that that worked out.
Yeah, but I mean, if I understand the way.
He needed to learn a lesson somehow.
Maybe it was the way it was staged.
I think it was the way it was staged. It was just silly. Yeah. It was just silly. You wouldn't just be driving.
We can't go, of course.
But it was so stupid.
This cast is good enough, and really it's excellent. It's an excellent cast. Yeah. And so I think that if any cast could pull off bad dialogue, this cast could do it. So it really puts emphasis on the script and the direction, that those are the two places where this story just fails. And one of the things that I agree with you, I think Superman as a character is frustrating, but I think he's only frustrating because no one's ever handled him right cinematically, except for the first couple of Supermans back in the 70s and 80s.
1 and 2 are much more really good in this movie.
And the reason why they're so good is because the focus really is, how do you get to Superman, a character who is impervious to, you know, to anything, any onslaught. Yeah. He himself is immortal. He can't be hurt. He can't be injured.
You get to him by the humans that he's trying to protect. Right.
That he's trying to protect.
And in this movie, there's one scene where they use that against him.
Yeah.
And it takes place with a family of three. Right?
Mm-hmm. No, there's two scenes.
Okay, what's the other one?
Where they show up at his mom's house and threaten his mom.
Yeah, but even that is so aside.
Yeah, it's almost perfunctory.
I agree.
And then it's gone.
But I agree with you.
It is a threatening of.
It is, but it's underused. It's still way underused.
Maybe it's because they move on too quickly. They don't make him feel it enough. They just start fighting again. But after that moment, there's just constant carnage of innocent people and innocent lives lost.
And I know that this is total disregard on Superman's part for what's going on.
It's like Transformers 3.
Yes.
It's just insanity.
Yeah. Yep.
And I know that people want carnage, and good on them for making some interesting action scenes. Yeah. I thought, as far as people with insane superpowers fighting each other,
the way they fought each other,
it was some of the best stuff I've seen.
So we need to wrap it. Where are you at?
I'm minor down on this, minor rock fist down, and it's because there were elements that I liked, but I do have to say that they should have skipped all the shit on Krypton.
Really?
Russell Crowe is a great person in this role, but he didn't need to be in it that much. We could have had him in as much as Marlon Brando was in the first one, and that would have been enough. Because that story gets repeated, that backstory gets repeated again by Russell Crowe. I think there's a lot of pacing issues. I think they needed a lighter touch with the script. I don't know. It's a minor rock fist down.
Trey?
I find the bloodless violence, like, really ugly. Really, really ugly in this. Because I think people walk out and be like, yeah, that was so fun. And it's like, except for the fact that you're ignoring the sort of thousands and thousands of people that were killed without ever a gesture or a mention.
Which is ironic, because we would normally give Zack Snyder a hard time for the ultraviolence.
Right. But I
either
feel
way,
like
he still doesn't know how to use
it. I feel like forcing ultraviolence on us at least makes us realize what's going on. This has thousands and thousands of people being killed.
Oh,
in
no,
Metropolis.
All those buildings were evacuated.
Yeah. And so
even Perry Smith stayed in one about 20 minutes too long. Finally, he goes, come on, guys, we're getting out of here. And I'm like, maybe you should have done that when the first.
Why are you watching
when the first building went down? Yeah. So I find that just despicable. So I think on that alone, I would normally be minor rock fest down on this had that not happened. And I think I've just got to go rock fist way down on this.
And I think the thing is that that there's such a serious tone, and then they don't address that. Yeah. If it was a lighter movie, sometimes it's easier to forgive that kind of stuff.
It becomes a character flaw, though, when Superman isn't trying to move the fight away.
And we've heard so much about, you know, him morally up to this point.
Exactly. But, that he's this morally upstanding character, and yet he's throwing Zod straight through a building, which then tumbles and collapses.
Yeah, they're hitting each other so hard.
It is despicable. It is absolutely despicable. in that, but other than that, the film is just a flawed film, and it would be a minor rock fist down. But because that is not addressed, and because I think it is a total mistake to keep selling like this massive amount of violence in this sort of bloodless, ugly way, is rock fist way down.
I give it a minor rock fist down. I actually like the stuff on Krypton. I had some problems with just some of the action scenes didn't really ring true, and I don't know. It was close. I if they'd done just a few things differently, I could go like a minor up, but no, it's a minor rock fist down. It's definitely the most restrained I've ever seen him in a live action movie, though.
Who's that?
Zack Snyder as a director, and I liked his cinematographer, the guy that he chose for that. But anyway, that's Superman. That's Man of Steel. So everyone go see it and tell us how wrong we are. And now, Eric, you're going to talk real quick about This Is the End.
Yeah, so this is Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who wrote Superbad, writing and directing this movie. This Is the End. And this is really based on there was a short film that they did with Jay Baruchel. Baruchel?
You're right. You're right.
I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Baruchel.
Called Seth and Jay Save the Apocalypse or From the Apocalypse or something like that. And it was a lark, and it was a fun little thing that they did. Well, they kind of expanded it into a full-length film, and it still feels like a lark. It still feels like this like inside joke, like this funny movie that they can go to parties and go, hey, look what we did with our friends. And their friends in this movie, of course, include James Franco, Danny McBride, Emma Watson, Craig Robinson from The Office, and these guys are all at a party at James Franco's house. And the main crux of the story is that Jay Baruchel is coming to L.A. to hang out with Seth Rogen, and Seth Rogen ends up taking him to this party. And he and Seth just aren't that good friends anymore, and they need to connect. But then Seth takes him to this party, and he feels really uncomfortable around all these people. Jonah Hill has a running gag where he doesn't like Jay, and Jay doesn't like him, but Seth has told him to make an effort. And so Jonah's just like, hey, guys, lay off Jay throughout the whole film, and it's totally false. The thing is that these guys are naturally funny. And there's something really liberating and funny about seeing them satirize all of their friends and people in Hollywood as really shallow and egotistical, but do it in a fun way, because we've seen that kind of satire before. Danny McBride, of course, is really over the top because all the characters he plays in his movies are really over the top. And they're basically all bad, self-involved people. And what happens is, during this party, the apocalypse begins to happen. And I'm not going to reveal what kind of apocalypse, but I will say that it's one that we haven't seen before. And that was very, very cool to see a different take on the apocalypse, especially with After Earth, Oblivion, The World's End is coming
out.
So
it wasn't a clone army of Tom Cruise that came down and invaded?
Oh, and World War Z. I mean, there's just an apocalypse movie every week this summer.
Yeah.
And this one doesn't have any zombies in it. So, so it all... Oh, all right, I don't know exactly where to go without spoiling anything.
Let's just drop the spoiler dome. We're going to have to...
No, right, it's okay, fine. It's okay. So, basically, this is a minor rock fist up for me. And, and the only reason that it's just a minor rock fist up is because Superbad for me was a solid rock fist up. Because even though the film is incredibly funny all the way through, nonstop laughs, I really felt like the character stuff worked. And in this movie, they're trying. We have to give them credit for trying to make the character stuff work. Seth and Jay are trying to patch things up. And James Franco is actually, again, like he was in Spring Breakers, fucking great. And in this movie, he has glommed on to Seth as Seth's new best friend. So Franco is kind of when he's having this big party at his house, he's got a big painting that has the name Seth Rogen in it, right next to a painting that says James Franco, and that's threatening to Jay because they're supposed to be the buddies from Canada,
right?
Before they came to L.A. and now he's big L.A. Franco is more than willing to make fun of himself, and again does a really, really funny job in this movie. And all of the things that they explore in the film of these guys being trapped in this house together and having to get along and being selfish and how that's a problem, they all acquit themselves admirably, some better than others. And some things happen that, again, that I don't want to spoil. They finally do get outside of the house, and then it becomes this crazy CGI movie that cost a lot of money, it looks like. I mean, the apocalypse is kind of awesome.
Expensive.
It's kind of expensive and kind of awesome in this film. That said, it doesn't have the character stuff that Superbad had. So it really just is a funny movie. And I think it might even be a movie that's only funny once.
Yeah.
Yeah, does it keep from being like annoyingly self-indulgent because it's all about movie stars being movie stars and our lives are hard because we're movie stars?
It keeps from being annoyingly self-indulgent in that it is consistently annoyingly self-indulgent and making fun of that.
Yeah.
Yes. And okay. So because they're poking fun at themselves nonstop, Franco has one of the best ways to exit the story, let's say, due to his own ego and selfishness that's just consistent with the tone of the film. It's all leading to something, and I will say that the ending kind of sucks. it's kind of awesome, but then it's also really fucking lazy, because when you think about...
it was all a dream.
Well, no, when you think about the kind of comedies that have come before it, to end the way they did is just kind of a cop-out. It's like, oh, it's a fun ending, but it's also like, you know... But I guess they kind of painted themselves into a corner and...
Sure.
Although a dream ending would be incredible if like they woke up from the dream and they were on the set of Freaks and Geeks, if that was
Bob Newhart,
ended, like they woke up on the set and they were getting
that
ready to shoot
a scene. That would have been better.
That would have been incredible. Anyway.
But no, it is a diversion. But it is a fun one. The thing I liked about it is that it made me laugh consistently. Mm. And there's a lot of jokes that don't work, but there's a lot that do.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what comedies we've seen this summer, but I don't think...
Not The Internship.
Well, I mean, I can't think of a movie that made me laugh more consistently, and that's enough for me to recommend a movie.
Awesome.
So it's a minor rock fist up.
Nice.
Cool.
Now, I would definitely recommend... If you don't go see it in the theater, unless you're like a big fan of the Brat Pack or whatever, what are they called now?
I don't know.
Unless you're just a huge fan of everything that those actors do, wait for it on video or whatever, if that's what you're going to do, because it'll work just as well there.
Okay.
But it's fun, man.
Awesome.
I don't know what to say beyond
that's
that.
It. It's that's all you need to say. If it's fun, it's fun. Dre, The East?
Yeah, The East. So Britt Marling co-wrote this script and acts in it. She was also in Another Earth. She was also in Sound of My Voice. And actually, Sound of My Voice is a film that she made with Zsolt Buttmunglige, who directed Sound of My Voice and directed
The
East as well.
And
they both co-wrote them. Right. So, and you can actually go online and check out an interview that I did with Britt Marling, where I ask her a lot of process questions. What was it like to co-write this, develop the characters, and then perform one of the characters? I'm always interested in those types of splits and things. But Britt Marling is very, very bright. And Zsolt Buttmunglige is really kind of this amazing, kind of sensitive, young, up-and-coming. And by sensitive, I mean sensitive in the way that he's perceptive about, like, how to push a story, how to mold a story.
Mm-hmm.
Young director. And
they're both about cults, too.
Yeah.
Both of the films.
Well, this one's not about cult. Really what The East is, and just sort of to break it down, is both Buttmunglige and Marling were trying to figure out, they both love these sort of Cold War era espionage thrillers. But they feel like the Cold War era stuff is just really played out.
Mm.
And I think they're right. And so they were trying to figure out a way to kind of update the espionage thriller. And so the way they did that is by a sort of homegrown terrorist group. It's a group of eco-terrorists. And Britt Marling plays this private investigating firm, an agent in that, and she's trying to infiltrate this.
She doesn't work for the government.
She does not work
for
the government.
She works for big corporations.
Exactly.
Nice.
Yeah. So she actually...
But then again, it's another story where she's trying to infiltrate and will that culture change her, right?
Exactly.
So that's kind of like Sound of My Voice.
Yeah, totally. I mean, she's switching the character she's playing. She's actually in this playing a much more difficult character than in Sound of My Voice, where you just have to be this sort of charismatic, maybe untrustworthy cult leader.
Yeah.
At least questionable cult leader. In this... she has a lot more ground to cover, both psychologically, emotionally, and physically. This was an incredible physical role where she had to do a huge amount of training to be able to, like, take on this role. She did a lot of her own stunts, things like that.
But in the movie, we've got, in the cult, we have Ellen Page.
Yep.
Alexander Skarsgård.
Yep.
Who else?
Those are
the main ones.
Those are the big names
in the Clarkson's
skull.
In the movie.
Yeah, Patricia Clarkson, Julia Ormond is in it.
Wow.
I mean the cast is pretty awesome, and you can tell just by what we listed off. It's half and half, male and female. So for an espionage thriller, that's pretty amazing. And I will also say this. They don't make any issue of it. It's not like a point to like make this a sort
it's
of
just
female.
As many females as
it
as,
just happens to be there. In fact, I don't think most people like if they go and see it after hearing this podcast, they'll notice like how good the female players are in this cast and how many of them there are. And like but if you went in blind, you wouldn't even notice it.
Right.
Just no issue is made of it, and I think that's a huge strength.
So my question about this movie is, after seeing the preview, it made it seem like it was very political and that it was going to take some sort of stands on certain issues. But then everything that I've read about it makes it seem like it's basically Donnie Brasco, where somebody goes undercover and gets changed, and which way are they going to go? Is this a character drama or is this a political drama?
It's a little bit of both. The political side of it is the engine that kind of drives the story. But the thing that makes it satisfying is the fact that the characters are very well defined, and it is the decisions that the characters make that ultimately, that's what you're invested in. But the political back and forth, the sort of big core against these environmental terrorists, that's what kind of sets everything in motion.
You keep saying terrorists. Do you believe that they're terrorists?
I don't believe that they're terrorists. And in fact,
have you seen the documentary about that guy, the eco-terrorist or whatever that came out a couple years ago?
Yeah, When a Tree Falls.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I saw that, and actually, in the uncut version of, I'm putting up some of the transcript from the interview, but in the uncut version, which you can listen to online. I actually talked to Britt Marling because in 2001, I was in grad school focusing on cultural studies, and I actually wrote a big paper on the ELF and looking at their sort of coded message systems and how these cells work together, because they don't really work together. They're just individual cells with the same ideology, and you could just claim it. So it was this really... interesting means of communication. So, no, I don't think that they're terrorists, because I don't think if your whole ideology is built around not harming individuals, if you're just you know, burning down SUV lots and things like that, that's
so
arson.
Terrorism for you is the loss of life.
Loss of life. Or injury to individuals. But if you're specifically not going, I don't think we can equate burning down an SUV with an injury to an individual.
So does the East play with those?
A little bit.
definitions?
Yep, a little bit. And their moral, there is a moral spectrum that is played out within the group itself, where you see individuals who are willing to cross certain lines and not others, other individuals who are willing to push it much further, who see that some push will achieve their goals.
What about the conclusion? Does it have a satisfying conclusion?
Yeah, I think so. I think that they do. Whenever a character is presented with, you know, oh, you've got to choose this side or this side, anytime you can kind of be flexible within that, that's when you're going to get to something more satisfying. And so I think they give you, as satisfying an ending as they can come up with. In this, and there's
well, that's know. Not really ringing.
No. Well, basically, it's kind of like if you answer the question this side or this side,
right.
That's upsetting, and they don't fully answer that question, and that's satisfying, is basically what I'm saying. You know, so you kind of paint yourself into a corner when you're like, which side's right, and then they kind of are able to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. So where do you come down?
I'm giving this a solid rock fist up because I think it does a lot of things really admirably. I think the update of the espionage thriller is satisfying. And again, it's a situation that you don't really even think about it. You don't spend too much time on it. And to me, that means that, you chose really well as how to update it, because I'm not there questioning why she's doing this, what's going on. You don't need a whole lot of like crystalline plot development to get to that. It just makes sense. It's like, oh yeah, that's a great update. That's a good choice. The implementation of the hugely talented female cast that you're not even going to notice, but is in an espionage thriller, which is a genre that you don't think about, a largely female driven cast. And the continuing developing talents of Zalba Ondlage and Britt Marling as writers also. Because I would say that this is more satisfying. I really enjoyed Sound of My Voice, but I would say this is definitely a step forward from there. So I'm going to go solid rock fist up. I think this is a thoroughly entertaining film on multiple levels. And if you just want a fun espionage thriller, it totally has that. Also.
Awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
There you go. We're going to end it there. Go see Heavy Metal this weekend.
And, oh my God, yes, see Heavy Metal.
Go see it. And we'll be back next week with World War Z. See you then.